Hi, I'm Jeannie. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. So, you know, nervous, of course. My sponsor says it's normal to be nervous. So that was just on my ride down talking to her. So I guess I'm very normal tonight. So, anyway. So my experience, strength, and hope, what can I say? I am one of five children, myself being the youngest, and four older brothers. So I got my way all the time. And, you know, we grew up in, I grew up in a pretty unsteady household. You know, they always say, my oldest brother has 9 years between the two of us, and they always say that the older one will always grow up in a different type of situation than the younger one will, and that we have found that true in our family, and my brother doesn't get it. So anyway, alcoholism trots through my family. It doesn't run. So we are, all four of us have now made coffee, and there's one who probably could come in and make some coffee himself, but that's his journey. So, you know, at a very young age, I could never understand, like, when people said when they took their first drink or whatever, and I'm always scratching my head, and I said, I finally realized when I was probably about 10 years old, I had to be either 10 or less. It was New Year's Eve, and my mother would bring out that big yellow Galliano bottle thing like that, and she would put all glasses up at, you know, 5 minutes to midnight, and all of us would get to taste that little Galliano. And do you know that I couldn't wait to the following year to get that little taste of Galliano? So now that was, more will be revealed in your story. So that was pretty shook up when I was like, I had to be, as I said, 9 or 10. Before I go on anymore, I am from the Stepping Up group, and I do have a sponsor. And I do have a grand sponsor, and I do have sponsees. And I think that's very important in my recovery. It has been very helpful. But anyway, going on with the story, when I was probably about four years old, both parents got very sick, and the whole family was separated. We all went to different friends, really, of my parents' homes. And actually only one uncle. Somebody went to the uncle with the boat. And, you know, that was horrible. It was just horrible. And I always had, like, this insecurity, I guess. You know, they left, and now, you know, is that going to happen again? Whatever. So then it was time to go to kindergarten. And guess who was a kindergarten dropout but me? After I bit the woman on the bus, that was the end. I didn't have to go anymore. So they let me stay home. But anyway, you know, but that was the difference. My oldest brother grew up in a very healthy environment. I grew up in a very sick environment. My parents became very sick at that point. My father suffered from, they called it schizophrenia then. Whether it was or not, one may never know. He was suicidal, attempted suicide, never succumbed to the disease, thank God. My mother was sick at a very young age with cardiac, and that resulted in the loss of my mother when I was 11 and my father when I was 12. So right then and there started, I guess, that, you know, coming into sobriety and learning about what happened. I was totally traumatized. I was terrorized. I had nothing but terror to think that, like, my one brother might leave me, or, you know, what have you. And, you know, it was really sad, and it was a hard time. I was going through adolescence, and I found the beer, and I found Friday nights. But I didn't belong out with the Friday night group that hung out on Avenue S. You hung out on the corner. That's where you're going to the corner. So, and I always never felt like I fit in. And so I would go up to the corner and take care of business, and then I would go home and drink, because there is, in the household, there are myself and four brothers, and there aren't any adults. The oldest, Mike, was 21 at the time, I think, and he had already been out of the house. So it was the 18-year-old and down to myself. And the 18-year-old was drinking, and that was sad to have to worry about him all the time and coming home drunk. And, you know, it was just upheaval and the fighting that went on. And, you know, I still to this day can't watch boxing. I can't watch anybody get hurt. I couldn't even in biology lab when you had to pit the frog on the pitting and stick the needle and the nerves would go. I was standing there crying. So, I mean, I can't even hurt a fly. It's just that's how turbulence there was in the family of the five of us. We did have an aunt that kind of oversaw the situation. But, you know, now in a situation like that, there would have been intense therapy. You know, five kids would not have been, four at the time, would not have been left alone in the home. And the oldest decides to move back, which that was it. The fighting really, really took off. And I was always running out. I was always the one, well, they called me the scapegoat, but I was always the one, the fixer, that had to try and fix and fix and fix and fix. And you don't have to fight, and you don't have to this and that. You know, I'll make you dinner. I'll make you lunch. I'll iron your pants, but charged $1 a leg, let me tell you. So on Friday nights, I got good money. When they wanted to go out, it was $2 per brother. So between the drinking that went on in the family, you know, it was right up front. I mean, I saw it with my mother, and still to this day, I'm still healing. I can remember my mother walking down the street as drunk can be. She used to hang out at the bar around the corner, the Steers Head. She didn't hang out on the corner. She hung around the corner. And one day she was coming down the block and she was weaving and I didn't know what was wrong. It's this big, you know. So I ran in the house and I hid because I didn't know what was wrong. And I still to this day I don't know what I have, so I leave it as it is. And that will get resolved when it gets resolved. So moving forward, you know, with this strong family history on both sides. My mother never called herself an alcoholic, but that's for her. But she drank like I drank, and I never wanted to be like her, and I never said that, and I wound up being just like her, like mother, like daughter. My father was a gentle soul. I was daddy's little girl. And that was probably the worst thing in the world that could happen to me, was to lose him. But life did go on. And I went through high school and I played basketball and, you know, but I drank. I drank on the weekends, you know, and then all of a sudden it started to drink when you were going into school. And again, was there help? There wasn't any help. There wasn't any therapy. There wasn't anything. And I was nothing short of angry. Anger. And I was in a Catholic, all girls Catholic high school. And my junior year, there was maybe four or five of us out that were out drinking in the morning before school. And we got caught. And I was asked to leave school. And none of the other girls were asked to leave school. And I think that has to do a little bit with my anger. But that's okay. And that's something that is in the resolving process as well. Because again, there was no therapy, there was no help. I could sit here and say there should have, could have, would have, but I know now, and in the field that I'm in nursing, I work with children, I can pass it on to families, you know, to get the help, and that's healing, helping heal. So, you know, with the drinking, it progressed in high school, went off to college, and I only went out to 50 miles out to Long Island, and I, you know, drank, but I studied really hard. I was a very good student, and then I played really hard. So, you know, that's just the way it went. And I succeeded in college, but I went to college for teaching. And when I finished college with teaching, I went back to Brooklyn, and I worked in a Catholic school, and the accountant told me that I'm working for less than the poverty level. So he said I might want to think another career. So I was offered a scholarship to St. Vincent's School of Nursing in Manhattan, which I did accept, and I did go to. And that was hard. But I studied really hard, and I played really hard, and I did really well. And I was angry, still angry. I was so angry. And they saw something in me. I was not introduced to the program. I don't know what I was introduced to, but I was asked to go to speak to somebody in the O'Toole building about alcohol. And probably was, you know, probably like, you know, what they have in the union, the woman or the guy that you go speak to. And he wanted to know about my drinking, and he said that Sister Mary Roberts sent me over, and I said, well, I said, I don't know. I said, what I'd like you to tell her is that I'm not drinking too much. I have no problem drinking, and I was really pissed, and that was that. So that was my first, not really introduction, but first time it was called on to me. And so I remembered that was in the back of my head, but I didn't know about AA. But I did have a brother, and I was probably about 19 or 20, and he was really sick. I mean, I was sick, but he was really sick. He was dealing the drugs. He was taking the drugs. What have you. But gratefully, he is in the program, and I think he has 27 or 28 years now. So, but I didn't know. All I know is that he didn't drink anymore. He didn't drug anymore. I didn't know what went on in these rooms. I did go to his first anniversary, and he did say, you know, like it was me that said to him, you know, Danny, you're just not my brother anymore. Can you please come back to be my brother? And, you know, that was, you know, his start of his journey. He went on to detox. And I remember the first night we went to visit him in detox, and all I could remember was loneliness in that room, and that was amazing, because at the end of my story, that's all I had was loneliness. So anyway, going forward, graduated college, did that, on to the nursing school. I leave there, and I'm drinking, but I'm a professional. I'm working nights, work 3-hour nights. I'm in my 20s. I can now party 4 days a week and then go back to work, and I had no problem. I was in my 20s, you know. So that was good. And the times were great. And then I had the opportunity to do the traveling nurse. And I traveled all around the country. 3 cars, 3 cats, 3 walkie-talkies, 4 cell phones. And that was a wonderful experience. But I did drink along the way. But not as alcoholically as it progressed. But, you know, moving forward, I moved, I had a dear friend that I did the traveling nurse with. She moved out to Colorado, and I went out there because they flooded the job market with nurse practitioners. I had studied out in Stony Brook. Again, I worked full-time nights and went to school full-time days, and I had one day, and one day I got wasted. Wasted, and then I did my work, and I did my schoolwork, I did it on the train, and I succeeded, you know, and I was able to do it. But they flooded the market, so I moved out to Colorado. They talk about geographical change, but really, I'm not sure that that really was a geographical change for me, because it was really because they had the job, and I needed to work as a nurse practitioner, and I'm forever grateful for that company, that Dr. Kimball, who gave me my experience and mentored me to become probably one of the best nurse practitioners that could be in his eyes. So, and I succeeded out there, but I crossed a line. I crossed the line many years ago when I was drinking on the corner and not having enough, but I really crossed the line where I went from weekend drinking to drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, to drinking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, straight through. So I knew I had a problem, but I didn't want to face it. And the job was going great. I bought a beautiful home on some property, and everything, life was going good. But I was not, it was not me. You know, the holidays, I wouldn't get back to New York. I would be invited to the boss's house. I'm drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning to get enough, you know, high enough, you know, that they wouldn't know it, but I can ease into their house. And, you know, it was just, it was emptiness. It was loneliness. It was, you know, crying about my parents, and that was an issue that never was resolved. It was carried with me till probably, I would say, 49, 50 years old, and it's a long time to carry something because I did not know. You know, when I first came around, I said my story was always a story of hope, and it still is a story of hope, but my story is also a story of I didn't know, okay? I didn't know that all these dots connected, and it all had to do with alcohol. So I stayed out in Colorado for 7 years. My family came out for one Christmas, and they were like, you need to come back. This is crazy. You're living on 5 acres in the woods, and I'm having a great time. I mean, I have a lot of friends. I'm very people-oriented, meet a lot of people in the practice. So I decided to come back. It wasn't really working out. I wasn't getting my way at the job, whatever. And so that probably was the geographical. So, and that move maybe was made about 10 years ago. And in that time, that's where the spiral began. I sold a home. I left a really good job. I moved across the country. And I was drinking. I was drinking. I couldn't handle any of this stuff. As a matter of fact, when I pulled out of that driveway of that home that I loved, that was a log home that I loved, I never looked back at it because it was all alcohol. It was all alcohol related. So I, you know, come back to New York via Culpeper, and I come to my uncle's, and I left via Culpeper. I come back to my uncle's, and everybody's there, and the whole family's together, and everybody's happy. And he looked at me and he said, are you happy you left? And I said, I don't know, Uncle Ned. I really don't know, because I didn't know. I didn't have the dots connected yet. And I was drinking so heavily that one night, you know, we all partied, and we were partying all afternoon. And, you know, I didn't have enough. Everybody was going to bed, and I wasn't done drinking. And there wasn't any more beer left, and I went to the hard stuff. And I went to the house, and my cousin was like, what the hell are you doing, Jeannie? You know, go up to Richard's, get to sleep. I said, Shazam, give me a couple of shots. Well, give me a couple of shots. I get on the golf cart. The shots hit me. I wound up going through this bean field, knocking out a whole ton of beans. And I get the golf, I'm like, don't know how to put it in reverse. And they actually seem taller than the bean field was this year. I don't know what kind of beans he had then. But anyway, so I get up to the house. I go pass out, go to bed. And I get up the next morning. And I come out on the porch, and I see all the beans wrapped around the tires of the of the golf cart, and my stomach sinks. And I'm like, oh, my God. So, of course, my cousins don't have any mercy, typical Irish family. And they're starting already. You had enough to drink last night. Look at what you did. Blah, 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 blah. So now I have to go down to the house and face my uncle who lets this farmer plant on his land. And he says, you didn't have enough drinks last night. You had to run to the... He says, here's the number of the farmer. Call him and tell him what you did. I was like, oh, my God, how can I do that? So I went up to the house. He says, you took out like $100 worth of beans. I'm like, oh, my God. Thank God I had money with me. I went up to the house. I grabbed $100, came down to the house, and I put it in his pocket. And I said, would you please call the farmer for me and give him $100? So I didn't have to face the farmer. But that I can laugh, and the family can laugh about that story now because it hopefully never, ever will happen again, and only good memories happen on the golf cart now. So I head back to New York, and I start this great job with the surgeon, and I'm drinking a lot. I can't handle it, you know, I really can't handle it. I moved into Rockaway. My family was in Breezy. It's kind of, we lived on a peninsula and of water. The bay was here, and three blocks down was the ocean. And I couldn't handle it, so it was bad. And I lost that job as a direct result of my drinking. Not on the job, but drinking at night and coming in with the attitude, the disease of attitudes. And boy, oh boy, did I have the attitude. And I was angry. That anger still was surfacing. So I lost this $110,000 job. And now what am I going to do? Collect unemployment and what have you. But I had money from selling my home, and I was able to do it. But I still didn't figure things out. So I had to leave this one place and move to another place. And that's all geographical. You know, it's not working out here. Let me go here. But I stayed on the peninsula and what have you. And I moved into an apartment where the people downstairs drank. And many years ago, I went out with my brother, who's a priest now, and we went out and had tequila, and this was in Manhattan, and he told me he was going into the priesthood, and we were going to celebrate. The next thing you know, we're in New York City, we're to the west, and we're heading north to New Rochelle. No idea how we got there, the car, the whole nine yards, and the next day I had the horrors. Boy, did I, guilt, remorse, shame, you name it, I had it. And I swore that day that I would never take tequila again. And I never touched tequila ever again until I moved into this apartment. And the spiral is happening, and it's happening. And you know what? Beer is not enough anymore. So the tequila comes into the picture. They would do straight tequila, but I needed to have it with, as a margarita, no ice and a double. So, tequila is what brought me to my knees and brought me into this program. I drank one night, and it was a blackout. And I came down with the dogs the next morning, and the girl opens the door. She goes, how you feeling? I had looked in the mirror. I had this big cut on, like, burn under my chin. I was like, oh, God, whatever, I don't know. So I'm good, everything's good, you know. She goes, all right. I said, I got to walk the dog. She goes, all right. She says, you know, do you know you were up down here last night? I was like, yeah, I was down there, and then I went to bed. She goes, no, after you went to bed, you came back down here for 3 hours. I was like, oh, my God, 3 hours I was down there and did not have any recollection whatsoever. And that was what scared the daylights out of me. But it didn't scare the daylights out of me because I drank for 2 more days. And I got up that Saturday, and I had called girlfriends who would justify my drinking. And I knew if I called them, they would say that I didn't have a problem and I could go on with this. And I did. And my girlfriend was like, Jeannie, you don't have a problem, and blah, blah, blah. So I made the call. I made the call to my brother, who was in the program, who actually had come around the house, left me the big book that I promptly threw in the garbage, And kept saying, let me take you to a meeting, let me take you to a meeting, let me take you to a meeting. So it goes to show that what I have learned is that not to 12-step your own family, because I was really angry with Danny. But it was Danny, the morning of his child's communion, when he walked in and his daughter was in her communion outfit, he was holding his son in his arms, and Kaylee was a little bit taller, and his wife. And it was that morning that I looked at him and I said, I want what he has. It wasn't the book that he put under my bed. It wasn't the crazy phone calls. Come with me, come with me. I know why he wanted me to come with him. He wanted to ruin my drinking. But needless to say, it was starting to be ruined anyway. So I made the call, and my first words to him was, Danny, I never want to feel like this again. And there was my surrender. And he said, fine, Jeannie, I'll take you to a meeting. So he's like, do you want to go to a meeting tonight? No, 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 not tonight. Not tonight. Dan, can we go tomorrow night? So I said, you know, I'm like really shook up. I said, I just need to take the dogs for a walk and go to bed. So he says, all right, Gene. He says, do you have anything in the house? I'm like, no, I drank it all last night, you know, or this morning, whenever. So I went to bed that night, and I knew the next day. And I got up, and I knew I was all right. I had this sense of peace came over me, and you know, to me, that was what I came to learn was my higher power, the God of my understanding, who touched my life that day when I called my brother and it was over. And my journey began. I walked in to that meeting, and all I wanted to do was go home. It was a speaker meeting. I have no idea what they said. One woman came up to me who wound up to be my sponsor. She said, you know, here's my name and number. Call me if you want to go to a meeting. And another girl walked up to me and she said, just remember your friends are in here, not out here. And I left with all that knowledge, and I went home with my brother. And he's like, do you have anything in the house? I'm like, no, Dan, I don't have anything in the house. I don't want to touch alcohol again. I don't want to feel like this again. I just want to get out because I'm ready to burst into tears. And he's talking and the tears, and I'm just like, and he said, you know, Jeannie, Mommy and Daddy would never wanted this life, any of us. He said, so, you know, just continue on your journey. And 7 years later, this November, my journey has continued. And I'm not going to say that it was easy, but it was very easy when I surrendered. And that surrender happened that day. So some people will say that they came in on the first step, and that's a term that I heard before. I feel as if I came in on the first step. I had already admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. And I was. I didn't want to feel like that. I just wanted to get sober. And my sponsor that I met that first night, she was very happy with me because all I wanted to do was get sober. There was no problems, you know. She told me to call, I called. She told me to make 90 meetings, 90 days. I made 90 meetings in 90 days. She said, she said, get a home group and get a commitment. And I did that, and the only thing that I did not do was I did not get a commitment because I worked at this point, after being in pediatrics 20 years, I don't have a job, and I'm working like as a visiting nurse doing adults, okay? I haven't touched an adult in 25 years, and nursing school was the last time. So I am just, it was just scary. It was really scary. And anyway, that all worked out, and I was able to, you know, find a job. And my sponsor had told me that a sober alcoholic is the best one on an interview. They're always the ones that'll get the job. And, you know, I waited patiently. I had to wait patiently. And we worked our steps, you know, slowly. I would never suggest this to anybody to work their steps slow, you know, as slow as I did. But I had a lot of things coming up that stopped, that slowed my progress with the steps. But I needed her to explain to me how my life wasn't unmanageable because I was a nurse. I made good money. I had a great apartment. I had everything. I wasn't hurting anyone. I lived by myself. I didn't know I was hurting my family. I wasn't coming for the holidays. I'd say I was coming. I didn't come. you know, my brother was in Brooklyn. I wasn't there. So the hurt was there. So, and the unmanageability was there as well. But then I had to come to believe. So, you know, I came to, and then I came to believe. And that took a long time for me to come through those first three steps with her. In that first year of sobriety, I would never recommend this to anybody either. My four brothers, my oldest brother, approached all of us and asked if we would like to go into counseling and try and resolve the conflict that we have, because Eddie doesn't talk to Dan, Patrick doesn't talk to this one, Jean. And I was always the one that was, come on, speak, you know, trying to, and I finally gave up in that first year of sobriety. I can't fix this. I can't fix this family, you know. There's a lot of bad stuff going on. So I agreed to go, and I was too young in sobriety to go. But I had a lot of support. I started a foundation, and I did what I was supposed to do. I called my sponsor. I called other people. When I came out of those meetings, you know, those Tuesday nights, I would call right away my sponsor, because I walked from, you know, like 34th Street up to, you know, Times Square. It was like a 12-block walk, and I'd be on the phone with my sponsor so I wouldn't stop for a drink. But what happened was I slowly started to landslide. And I had to, many years, seek outside help, and that's mentioned in the big book, and I think that's very important that people who need outside help follow through with it, because I am here today, not only because of this program, because I did go out for outside help. So I'm going into this deep depression and can't go to this counseling anymore. So we go to the last session. I call the guy that morning and I said, I'm crying all the time, this, that. So it's okay, no problem. So we go. So the brother that I was closest with said, well, at least I'm not the one that broke it up. Guilt, 100% guilt on me that I broke up this family session where we were trying to heal this. But this was not healable at that. It's just not, and I can explain that a little bit. So the other brother that sat there like this, that never trusted anything, he was like, you know, Patrick, you knew this guy before, blah, blah, blah. You know, so it was just like, nobody was ready. You know, some healing happened. I opened my heart when I walked through those doors and actually started to build a relationship with the brother that's an Irish twin. We're just a year apart. And going forward with that, I went for the outside help, and I started to get a little bit better. And I did get a job. I was in this job, and I wound up losing that job. And again, that was because of my attitude. And had a bad attitude. I was angry. Nobody helped me. I didn't know. I didn't connect the dots again. So here I am in a major depression, suicidal, in sobriety. This is now going forward a couple of years. And I guess it had to be my fifth year of sobriety. I got my sixth year coin here. So my fourth and fifth year of sobriety, I became suicidal, and I reached out for help, and there was somebody that we knew that was a doctor, and he worked with, you know, people with addiction and what have you. And this guy out of pro bono did therapy with me for a year. And I had gone through the steps with my sponsor. I had done the fourth step. I made that searching, fearless moral inventory. And she said, just don't purposely leave anything out. And I didn't. I didn't think I left anything out. I did what, you know, was in the big book. And I went through, I admitted the exact natures to my wrong, to my sponsor. It actually, the fourth and fifth step we did together because I needed help with the fourth step because I just couldn't get it, you know, right. So we sat. So in doing the fourth step, we did the fifth step. So that was actually good. I was ready to have God remove all my defects. I asked him to remove my shortcomings that are very much part of my life today. But they're at bay. You know, it's like that game, I forget what they call, you know, you hit it and the other one pops up and you hit that one and they pop up. So, you know, today they're like this, they're all down. But, you know, yesterday there was a couple that were going up and down, you know, whatever it was. I made a list of persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. And that's all I had to do was make a list. And that's what I did. I made a list. And then I had to make direct amends to people. And I did make amends to some people. I still have amends. And I've done living amends. There was amends in that family therapy, whatever you want to call it, that family time together. There was some amends that took place there. And what my sponsor had said about the fourth step was that if anything came up, we would get it in the tenth step. So with this therapy, with this gentleman, I didn't know. And I went to him. I emailed him and I told him who I was, and he remembered who I was, and told him I was suicidal and that I needed help. And he had me come in to the office, and I hit it off with him right away, and I cried. And I can tell you I cried for 1 year in the rooms. I came to meetings every day. What I did was I called somebody in the morning and I said to them, will you pick me up for the meeting tonight? And they said yes. So that was a commitment that I made to that meeting. So I couldn't say no later. So right away in the morning, I could not get out of bed. I got out of the bed to walk the dog. The poor dog just laid in bed with me for months. But you know what? I wasn't working, so I'm grateful. There was a time for me to come and connect the dots and heal. And, you know, things came up, and what I learned was my brothers and I hold a trauma bond, and the best situation for me is to be away from my brothers, unfortunately, because when I'm near them, I cry, it brings up to it, they know how to push your buttons, what have you. So that was the biggest thing the therapist said, you need to get away from your brothers. I'm doing some side stuff, photography from my one brother. Did I realize I did it every 2 weeks and I was sick from the time I left him to the time I got back? I was sick to my stomach that I had to see him again. And this was all that was coming up in the therapy. So I learned about a trauma bond. Then I saw it. I mean, I saw what happened. And I worked with this guy, and I worked very hard, and we did focalizing, and that anybody can look up on the internet, I'm not going to get into it, but we did focalizing, and that was really helpful, and we did sit down, you know, and talk face to face, and when you left, you never knew what the next week was going to bring, never knew, and I'll give an example of that. I left one week crying and crying and got on the bus and got home and took the dog out and went right to bed. And that person would pick me up and I'd go to the meeting and I'd cry. My brother would be there. My brother would, like, hide in the back of the room. He didn't know what to do. So I am watching my niece's newborn baby on Thursdays. And the therapy's on Tuesdays. So there was a thing of child abuse that came up with one of the priests in Good Shepherd in Brooklyn. And sexual abuse or what have you. And my niece was very, very close with this priest. And she grew up knowing this priest, and it was very hard for her to come to terms with that this had happened. And before that had happened, when I was about 19 years old, I was walking down the street with my brother Eddie, the closest brother that I had. And there was a gentleman walking down the street, and I turned around and I looked at my brother and I said, "You know what, Ed, that man should go straight to hell and be arrested and go to jail for the rest of his life." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because he abused me when I was little." And he said, "He wouldn't do that. He's such a nice man." What did I do? Write down. And I held that. I didn't know. There was the fourth step. Made a search and feelless. It wasn't there. It wasn't there. My niece comes home all upset about this priest. I'm standing there holding the baby. And my niece turns around and says, "How can it be, Aunt Jeannie? He's such a nice man." I got like this kick in my stomach. I'm telling you, I've never felt anything like it, but it was real and it hurt. And I just looked at her and I was like, "You know what, Catherine, I have to go." I said, "Because you know what? That's what Eddie said to me many, many years ago." And I was, you know, again, never. So we know what next week's topic in therapy was this guy and, you know, whatever it is, you know, what it is. So, you know, the suicide, I tried to get my brother to help me. He couldn't help me. I talked to him a little bit about this guy that, you know, what he did. And he's like, "Well, where were Mommy and Daddy?" Well, where the hell was Mommy and Daddy? Mommy was around the corner. I don't know where Daddy was. Daddy was a sick man. He was in and out of the hospital all the time, you know. I don't know where they were. And I came to learn in therapy that my brothers couldn't help me. They can't help me. I can only help myself. And people like you and people in Rockaway were the people that helped me get through all of what came up. So there was a lot. So much came up. And, you know, I remember my sponsor saying, "Jeannie, you never told me that." It's like, I didn't know it was there. And then this. So let me tell you, I did one heck of a fourth step. And it was good. It was done in a safe. I was safe when I did it. And I didn't know I was doing a fourth step till I really, she pointed out, you know, she said, "That didn't come out in your fourth step," you know. So that, with that being said, that I continued with the therapy. And I was part of Hurricane Sandy. And I lived in Rockaway. And as I said, the bay was on one side and the beach was on the other. And I had the most wonderful 7 years of my life at the beach there with Rockaway AA. There's just something about the AA down there that's, you know, everywhere you go, anywhere you go, AA is different. And that night, the ocean met the water. And in 3 hours, devastated that whole area. And I was part of that devastation. And I went to a friend's house. Well, my brother was going to go over the bridge. They were only letting certain people go over the bridge. And my brother had come to check on me that morning because my nephew, of course, lived up the block. So whatever, I'll leave that alone. He came to my house and, "How you doing?" I said, "All right." I said, "Are you getting off the peninsula, Mike?" And he says, "Yeah, I'm going to be getting off later." I said, "Would you make sure you come get me?" And he said, "Sure." So I call him up later. The cell service is so spotty. It was unbelievable. You know, you couldn't move. You had to stand on the beach. It was freezing. It was snowing. It was raining. It was, you know, whatever. And I'm calling him, and I'm like, "Mike, where are you?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm in Brooklyn." I said, "You're in Brooklyn?" I said, "I thought you were coming to get me." So I said, "Okay." On the phone with the therapist, screaming and yelling. I mean, you want to talk about stress. You know, you have no home to live in. The entire place is in devastation. They're setting up tents, warming tents, and oh, it was just a nightmare. I went to a friend's house, finally got over the bridge, as they say, and I went to a friend's house and was not a sober friend, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And she couldn't handle the crying. And She asked me to leave, which was fine. I understood, you know. But that was a gas shortage going on or something in New York, and people, the lines. So I called a friend, and let me tell you, she was there in 10 minutes. And out the door I went. That was that. I went back to a friend's house, and they were all getting in the car, and they were going over to a friend's house that hooked up some kind of heating system, whatever, and we were having an AA meeting. And I was at home, and I brought my tears there, too. But it was great to be with the people. And we met every night, whether it was in that house that was warm or the place that I stayed at. We met every night for an AA meeting. We shared dinners that we had, you know, what have you. And then ultimately, a very, very big decision had to be made of where I was going to go. Was I going to go back over the bridge to Brooklyn? I hadn't been in Brooklyn since I was 19 years old. I left Brooklyn. Brooklyn, you know, it's just too crowded and just not my style anymore. And my cousin kept calling from here, how you doing? Why don't you come down here? My aunt and uncle's house was here. And they have passed away, and it's in an estate. And I had lost my car and, just whatever. And finally, my other cousin called, and he said, Jeannie, we're coming to get you. And I was like, all right, I'll come. And with that, all my friends just said, you're like a new person. I had made a decision. I was coming down here, and I was fine. People saw me in the rooms crying and crying and crying. It's as the therapist said, it took a hurricane to separate you from your brothers. And I knew, and it did, and that's when I understood a trauma bond, because when I got a phone call from them, I would get off the phone and I would cry. When they would text me, I'd get off the phone, I'd get off the text, and I would cry. So I had to write the email, if you love me, you will please let me heal, I'll be in touch with you, and that's the way I left it with them. So it's been an incredible, incredible journey. And I now, when I got here, healed somewhat. I'm still in the healing phase. I still wasn't working. I was on Social Security disability, and which was a godsend. How do you ever get that on the first shot with the suicide and all that? I got it. So I didn't have to work. So I was able to recover in my aunt and uncle's house on this beautiful farm. And I went to meetings every single day. And I got better. And my cousin was like, Jeannie, why don't you just look for a job? And I was like, Richard, you don't understand. I'm crying every day. Why don't you just look? And this job kept popping up and popping up. Well, hence, lo and behold, today I still hold that job. It'll be a year in March. And in that year, from coming down here, having nothing, I have bought a new home on 4 acres just down the road from my uncle's farm, which is actually really home for me, because I didn't, you know, when my parents died, that was a nightmare. That Brooklyn scene was a nightmare. So I'm actually back home. And, you know, I'm grateful. And every day I'm grateful. And when I was very sick, I went to a meeting one night, and my girlfriend TT was standing there, and I was sobbing. And she said, what's the matter? I said, well, the therapist has asked me to go to the hospital to check in. And I never was in the hospital before. And I didn't want to do it. And there was another option. And the option was to go away to this place called Kripalu. And it was a yoga place. And to spend a week up there. And I didn't have the money. The next day, the whole thing, if you smile, you can't cry. Next day, the whole thing was paid in full. And the following Sunday, how I ever did it, I drove up to Boston. And went to Kripalu for a week. And it saved my life. And on that morning that I went to Kripalu, I went to a meeting, and it's a gratitude meeting. And one of my girlfriends was sitting next to me, had no idea what was going on. The car was packed. Everything was ready. I was going to the meeting, and I was going up to Kabbalah. And she passed me this piece of paper. And this is something that's been missing for a year, because all my stuff was in boxes for a year, and now it's not in boxes. Because I live here. I have my own home now. And it was gratitude. And one of life's greatest gifts is gratitude. And it is free for the choosing. Thank you for this gift and the gift of free will. As I recognize and accept that I have a choice about the way I live, that I see life, I truly appreciate all that I have been given, as well as all the things I have lost. Remind me always that the most important things are without price, health, happiness, and relationships. As I grow, I learn to be grateful for every experience. When sorrow comes my way, which I couldn't even get that line out, comes, allow me to be open to your grace so that I may recognize your compensation. When joy comes, I will say thank you and remember this is the path to serenity. With this attitude, each day becomes a day of thanksgiving, and there never goes a day that I am never thankful for what has happened, what I've been given in this program, the people I've met in this program, for every single moment from the day that I walked through these doors to the day I'm standing here today. I am one grateful person. I live a free and happy life. My parents, I could never talk about them before, and I could talk about them. They didn't exist. There was never a picture in my house about when the pictures all come out. They're coming out as well. And that's many years. It's 39, 40 years now. And the pictures will come out. So I leave you with that I continue every day to take personal inventory. And when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. And I have a hard time with that. But I do it. And it might not be right that second, but it comes a couple of minutes after. And I sought through prayer and meditation, and that gift that I received to go to Kripalu taught me about yoga and meditation, and I practice that. Not on a regular basis, I practice it on the weekend. And that is where so much spirituality comes. And I am so close to the God of my understanding those two mornings. Not that I'm not every day with this beautiful country that surrounds me and the ride down here with the absolutely gorgeous Blue Ridge Mountains. I can't tell you, you know. So I make conscious contact with God as I understand him. And as I say, on my way down, talking with my sponsor and watching those mountains was my conscious contact tonight. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And that spiritual awakening came. And I remember when it came. It's my fifth anniversary. I had finished my steps in my fourth year. And that's why I say, please don't do it the way I did it. But there was a lot going on, as you can tell. And I was standing there at my fifth anniversary. And I said, you know, something changed this year. And I didn't know what it was. And it dawned on me. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So I'm on this journey with you. I thank you very much for having me, Village Speakers Group. Sam texted me yesterday. And he said, you know, we're looking forward to seeing you. And do you need anything? And just let me know. And I just texted him back, Sam, guts only. So I guess I have guts. Thank you very much.